Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us today for this ASI education webinar on strategies for buying or selling your promo business. I'm Chris Ruvo, News Director with ASI Media, and I'm joined today by Jamie Watson, a partner at Certified Marketing Consultants. CMC is an Indiana headquartered firm that specializes in advising promo companies on private sales, acquisitions, and business valuations. And as such, Jamie is an expert on the nuts and bolts of buying and selling a business. She's here to share that expertise with us today. A few quick things before we get started. Strategies and tips you hear today shouldn't serve as a substitute for getting legal advice from a lawyer and potentially other consultants if you're looking to buy or sell your business. The insights are meant to be informative and helpful, but not the definitive final word on your particular situation. Also, if you have questions, type them in the chat. We'll try to get to as many as we can. So, Jamie, thank you, of course, for being with us today.
Sure. My pleasure.
So we kind of broke this down into two segments, if you will. First, we're going to look at things from a seller perspective and then from a buyer perspective. So on the selling end of things, if I decide that I'm interested in selling my business, what are some of the first steps and considerations I should take?
Sure. You know, the process of selling a company, it's usually a once in a lifetime process for a lot of people. So it can be somewhat overwhelming. I like to say, it takes a little bit of soul searching when you first go into it. And the first thing that I tell people to do is kind of make a wish list. Basically, what is your timeline for potentially selling your business? You know, if you're selling to retire, when do you want to retire? When do you want to be out and work backwards from there? What is your goal with regard to value? What do you want to get for your business? And then figure out whether or not that's, we'll talk about valuation later, but figure out whether that's reasonable. And then what would you want your ongoing role to be, if anything? You know, do you want to have an ongoing role? What do you want it to look like? Do you want to be in sales? Do you want to be in more of a managerial position, or do you just want to be done completely because, you know, you've done enough and you're ready to retire? So the first thing I do say is just make that wish list, because at the end of the day, there's nobody that knows what you want better than you. You know, advisors can't make decisions for you. They can try and help you and guide you to make the best future for yourself. But if you don't know what you want that future to look like, it's difficult to then advise people. So that wish list is the first place to start. And then have a confidential conversation with your CPA, your attorney, or a qualified representative for you. Just to get organized, assemble the team that you think that you're going to need in order to get, you know, through the process of selling your company. That said, just tell as few people as possible. Don't tell anybody that doesn't absolutely need to know what you're doing.
And I could hazard a guess as to why, but why is that a smart thing to do?
Well, you don't want anybody to know that you're selling your company that doesn't need to know, because you don't want anybody, you don't want employees to panic, you know, you don't want your customers to panic and think, you know, now I have to find somebody else to get my goods and, you know, that sort of thing from. So you just want to keep it as close to the vest as possible.
All right.
So good question.
Good. So it's kind of almost, you're creating, you call it a wish list. I almost look at it as like a vision board or something like that. You know, you're like, hey, this is what I'm, this is where I want to go in an ideal scenario. And I thought through that. And once I kind of have some of that ideal scenario in place or some sense of it anyway, I'm then going to some of those professionals, as you mentioned, lawyers, consultants, the CPA, people who can actually start giving you real world insights on how you can get there and kind of move toward that. And while I'm doing all that, I'm kind of being hush hush about it. I'm not broadcasting to the world that these are steps that I'm looking to take. Is that a fair sum up, you think?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. I mean, yeah, I think all of that is correct. And also kind of the last point is probably the point that is not very exciting for people, but make sure that the representation of your company from a financial standpoint, which is going to be your financial statements, make sure those are in order. You know, most buyers want to look at 5 years and make sure that their representative, you know, look at them and make sure the representative of what your company's potential is. So if you've got some personal or discretionary expenses in there, identify those, make sure that you can identify those to a buyer so that they can back those out and normalize those expenses. But overall, before you even get to the valuation stage, you need to make sure that you have those solid financial statements right.
Okay. This is we had a question come in. I'm going to take it because it is financial related and you could just bring it up. The question is, what is a typical EBITDA, I think he's saying multiple of for so an earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization multiple for promo companies. Is there such a thing as a typical multiple?
I wouldn't say there's one typical multiple, and I was going to speak to that a little bit in the valuation part, but and I could just go to the next question because I think that we're going to answer that right now is
Okay.
once you've gotten to the point where you've got your wish list and everything, what's the next step, right? What's
Sure.
going to happen? Yeah. And you want to make sure that you get a valuation from a qualified valuation professional. You don't want to use rules of thumb. You don't want to find out what your friend sold their company for and try and extrapolate what your company might be worth because there are so many different nuanced situations that you don't want to just use a general multiple. Now, I can tell you that there's a range, but that range is big, right? So it's going to vary. And you don't in this industry just use one valuation method. Use several valuation methods, and then those intersect, and then it's like a check, and you know that you have the right value. So anyone that provides you like a multiple or a rule of thumb, a strict comparison to another company, without the context of understanding your company is really doing you a disservice because there's so many unknown factors. Having
Interesting.
said that, we are looking at probably between 3 to 5 times EBITDA in this industry,
Okay.
usually.
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 Okay. All right. And we want to be sure that everyone understands that that answer is caveated on everything that you said previously, that it's that there's a lot more variables than just that in play, but you
Right.
can see a range in that general area. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. It's a good question and it's a common question, but and there's nothing wrong with asking it and getting the answer, but I don't think it's a substitute for getting a true valuation picture of what your specific needs were.
Okay. How and you mentioned some of this already, but how do you then come to understand the value of your business? What are some of those different valuation metrics, if you will, that you tend to look at?
Sure. So, we look at profitability. So the thing that you were saying earlier was EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, which in reality is cash flow. Like, how much cash is your company creating? And that's a big factor. And then, in addition to that, we look at gross margin. Buyers will look at different lines of the statement depending on what their intentions are with the company. But most buyers look at gross margin as one indicator as well. Like I said, you want to get the valuation, but then you want to really understand what's driving it. There are so many misconceptions out there. Things that don't drive value are like the number of years you've been in business. There's no correlation there. Undeveloped potential, things that could be opportunities in the future. Those could have value if you're willing to stay around and help develop that potential, but if you're just going to sell and leave, then you're not going to get paid for that kind of value. What your revenue was 5 years ago versus what it is now, it's not going to have near as much of an impact on value. So, current financial results are going to have the biggest impact on value because at the end of the day, a buyer isn't an investor. And investors care about two things. They care about risk and they care about return. So those are, they care about the return and then they care about the risk of getting that return. So, it's a very financial conversation with a lot of other aspects to it as well.
In a lot of interesting stuff there. We had a question come in, kind of goes back. Let me jump here. Just looking at some of the ones coming. Embarrass me half a second. So when you're thinking of selling, this kind of goes back to the first question a little bit. Should you tell independent commissioned reps that that's something that you're thinking of doing? So it kind of goes back to when you were saying, hey, maybe keep things hush. Does that always apply? Does it apply to reps too?
Yes, I wouldn't tell anybody. I wouldn't tell independent reps. There's no reason for them to know. The time to tell them is when you have a buyer and you have an offer and you have a thoughtful transition plan in place. You don't want to tell somebody if you don't have the answers to their questions. So once you know the answers to all of their questions, then you can help them.
Oh, another question here. If a company has a negative EBITDA, how do you value it?
Well, there's a lot of things to look at in addition. So buyers will look at something called a contribution margin, but the real, which is basically, how do we eliminate all the expenses that are not going to be ongoing to get to a true picture of what the company's potential is? But it's really going to depend on why it's negative. Why is it negative? Is there a dip in sales? Is it overstaffed? Are there just too many people? Or do you live in a place where you're paying rent for a really, and there's just so many reasons that we dive into in the valuation process. Maybe there's some discretionary expenses going through the financial statements that need to be normalized out. But generally, most of the companies that we look at, even if they have negative earnings, they do have value still.
All right, very, very interesting. And thank you everybody for the questions. Keep them coming. We'll try to get to as many of them as we can. And Jamie, thank you for responding so succinctly on the as they come at you.
Yeah, those are great questions.
So you have some sense of your business value now. You kind of have your vision in place for where you want to go with the sale. How do you proceed about to find a buyer? Basically, how do you go about marketing that you want to sell your business, or do you market that you want to sell your business? How does this come together? Is there such a thing as a typical scenario?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the best buyers can come from a lot of places. They can be competitors. They can be, like-minded companies that are already in your space. There's a lot of platforms out there and buying groups and all of that. That might make a lot of sense because if you're on the same platform, then there'll be less of a transition headache, with technology, of learning new technology, et cetera. There are a lot of places that you can find buyers, especially on the distributor side in this industry. There's a lot of active buyers out there. And I think a lot of distributors actually get calls regularly from potential buyers. So that's one place. We use a buyer list that we've developed in-house, but there's probably other places that you can get lists in the industry if you're wanting to market your company. But the most important thing in the process is, no matter where you find your buyers, make sure you keep it confidential, not just within your company, but with the buyers as well. So if somebody reaches out to you and says, I'm interested in talking about buying your company, and you're interested in having that conversation, the first thing you want to do is get that NDA in place, that non-disclosure agreement, to make sure that whatever you tell them is covered under that non-disclosure agreement. So that's a really important part. And you just want to make sure you're protecting your employees and your stakeholders and your clients and everybody. So.
All right, very, very good. More questions coming in. We're definitely getting some good engagement today. I think people are very interested in this topic, so I'm going to throw a few at you here if you don't mind. One is just, I think, kind of broad. Just what does an evaluation process cost? Is there such a thing as a typical cost?
Oh, sure. Well, I think a lot of valuation firms probably charge minimum of about $5,000, and it can go upwards to, depending on how large the company is. The really large ones, it can go very high, 20,000 and up. We try to do, if it's us, we try to do an industry-specific one. So usually the cost is a little higher if you study outside the industry because they have to research the industry and look up a lot of industry information. We try and do some really cost-effective, economical type valuations for people that are closer to 2,000. We even do, for really small companies, we'll do a $1,000 valuation. It's an informal look at it. It doesn't include a lot of schedules, but it does include the full analysis and how we get there. So I know that's a really big range, but our fees can run from 1,000, and this is on the distributor side. Suppliers are just a little bit more, but yeah, it can run 1,000 to about 10,000.
All right, very good. And that certainly gives people a range to play with and puts them in a ballpark. So hopefully that was helpful. Another interesting question here regarding valuation. Does customer goodwill and repeat business increase value? Is that measurable and quantifiable in some way?
So that's a good question. Without getting too technical into valuation, if there aren't a lot of hard assets in this industry, and by that I mean there's not, construction industry has a bunch of trucks and a bunch of equipment. In this industry, unless you're doing some embroidery or something like that, you don't have that. So anything above and beyond the value of your hard assets is going to be goodwill. And yes, there's a lot of it in this industry. But what's creating that goodwill is the ongoing revenue stream. So it's not like here's the value of your company and then you add some for goodwill. The whole thing is a value and then some of it gets apportioned to goodwill. So there's always goodwill in this industry on the distributor side, like I said, just because there's ongoing revenue stream without a lot of tangible hard assets involved.
All right, very interesting. Hopefully that answered that question for everybody who's asking. Now, you kind of answered this to a degree already, Jamie, but I'll ask it anyway. You want to sell your business, and you have an interested buyer or two already. You don't need to go in search of one. Does that change anything in the process, other than maybe skipping a step or two, or is it largely the same process?
I mean, it changes it if from our perspective, if we're not going out to market a company. So, I mean, maybe it would be helpful to give them a little bit of background about how people in my position might work. Usually, you get the valuation. Everybody comes to a meeting of the minds on an asking price, and you kind of draw up a deck or a book that tells about the business. So. And that's a pretty comprehensive look at the business usually. And the preamble to that is going to be a smaller one-page, sheet that says, here's a little bit of information. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but there's an NDA. If you're interested in learning more, sign the NDA and we'll send you the more comprehensive book of information. So most brokers will send that out to buyers. So if you already have a buyer that you're working with, you will skip that step. I mean, unless you want to do that as well and bring other buyers into the mix, you'll skip that step and you'll just be looking at that one buyer and negotiating with that one buyer. And frankly, if you think it's a good buyer for you, there's no reason you need to do the first part. Sometimes the best buyers are the ones that have approached you that have a sincere interest in your business.
I was going to ask you, is it wise to pursue more than one offer, to try not to create a bidding war or something like that, but to seek other, to see what others might be interested in paying? But you're saying if you really feel like you have the right person or company, that it's good to go with that.
If you feel like you have the right cultural fit, the right connection, I always think a bird in the hand is worth way more than two in the bush. I just think that buyers, if they've approached you and they have a sincere interest, then it's worth exploring that. And then if that doesn't go anywhere, you can always go the other route. But if you try and go the other route and push that buyer aside, sometimes, that buyer isn't there when you go back. So.
Great point. Great point. You might lose the right one, right? So,
I mean, depends on the situation, but yeah.
okay. All right, we had another question come in. This person is asking, in selling, does your corporate entity status matter? So S corp versus C corp versus LLC. How does that all factor in?
That's a good question. It doesn't necessarily matter to the buyer, but it will matter to the seller. So, without getting into too much tax law, an S corp is easy. Most buyers are going to do what we call an asset sale versus a stock sale, which just means they're not buying your corporate shell entity. They're buying the assets out of it. And then you dissolve that entity. But that doesn't mean they're not buying your name. Your name is going to be one of those things that they're buying. That's actually an asset of the company. That's easy. S corps are easy. C corps are tougher because if a buyer just wants to buy the assets out of the C corp, they're going to buy them. The C corp's going to get the funds. And then when they distribute those funds, the shareholder's actually going to get taxed on those funds. Whereas in the S corp, they don't. So if you have a C corp and you're not looking to sell anytime soon, I would convert it to an S corp or at least explore converting it to an S corp with your attorney and your CPA. If there's a reason why you're not an S corp, then you'd want to figure out what that is. But beyond that, that's really the one main distinction in entity type is whether or not it's so if you do have a C corp and you do want to sell soon, don't go through the process of converting, try and do a stock sale versus the asset sale where they're buying the whole entity.
All right, good stuff. Hopefully that answered that question for everybody. Move on to another one here. So I want to sell my business, but I want to remain involved in it. Maybe I'm an owner and I want to be, I just want to sell going forward. I want to take some of the pressure off, or maybe I'd like to even be in a leadership or director's role. How do I arrange that as part of the sales process?
So go back to your wish list and make sure that you have that included in that wish list, right? And just be upfront with the buyer about what you want. Buyers love it when you stay on, but they love it when you stay on in the sales role because you have that relationship, and this is obviously a relationship industry. You have that relationship with that client, and if you don't leave, most likely that client's going to stay. That point of contact is important to buyers. So if you do leave, then you have to do a thoughtful transition plan, and that's okay too. But usually buyers, they're either going to pay you a commission or they're going to pay somebody else a commission. So to them, it's not going to make any difference. I mean, that's generally the rule in this industry. It's not going to make any difference whether they're paying it to you or they're paying it to somebody else. To them, it's the dollars are the dollars. But if they have you and you already have that relationship, that's a win-win. And as far as a director or a leadership role, that's going to be case by case. So if a buyer sees value in bringing you on in that leadership role, that's great, but they might actually have a fully staffed leadership team. So at that point, if you want one of those leadership roles, then you have to weigh the whole picture. Is this even the right buyer for you? Or if that part is important to you, then it's possibly you might want to step into a different role at a different buyer.
Great stuff. Bunch of questions coming in here. So let me take you to one here. Have you found, Jamie, that buyers from outside the promo industry are willing to pay higher multiples for distributorships? What's been your experience there?
Not necessarily, maybe at a very high level, at a private equity level where they're not in the industry, but they want to be in the industry. But generally, all buyers are kind of looking at it from a risk return standpoint. If they're paying a higher multiple, or they might not pay it in the same way, they might be paying different structures, but generally, I think they pay the same multiples. I think they're looking at the same numbers, they're doing the same analysis.
Okay.
There might be some that have some sort of synergistic reason for buying the company, and in that way, they might pay more multiples, but it's not super common.
Okay. All right. So generally speaking, they're looking at whether it's in the industry or outside the industry, they're looking at what a business is worth, and that's really what they're basing their offer on. Speaking more financial things here, what are some financial payout considerations beyond business sale price that are sometimes considered in a transaction?
Sure. So let me turn this up a little bit. There's a lot of, so I was just touching on one. Obviously, the price is the big consideration, but just as much of importance is the structure, right? So if somebody could say, I'm going to pay you $1 million for your company, but if they're going to pay you $1 a day for 1 million days, that looks different than if they're going to pay you $1 million today. So the structure is really important. It's a really important consideration. So understand how that's going to affect your payout. And it might be, so the different structures are, there's overtime versus now. And then there's also fixed, which can still be overtime, it's just fixed, versus contingency, which is dependent on the performance of the company. So there are a lot of things to consider in the structure aspect of it. You might get compensation for a non-compete agreement, but usually that's, we're going to pay you X for your company and we're going to allocate something to a non-compete. We're not going to pay you an additional amount for a non-compete. So that's usually how buyers look at that. And then obviously the ongoing salary and commission is a big consideration if you're going to continue working. And sometimes owners that have been working their fingers to the bone for years owning their own small company, it's, we all know is difficult and a lot of work. Sometimes you can take some chips off the table and actually make more in commission than you ever did running the company. So, you
That's
know, sometimes the owners are the most underpaid employees at the company. So,
interesting. That's interesting. Interesting.
I know there's some owners out there that are shaking their heads. Yes.
I could see it all happening digitally here behind the scenes. Interesting question came in. I think we're going to talk a bit about this later as well, but let's just address it now because it's all related to financing. What percent of a distributorship sales do you usually see when there's some seller financing, and normally how much? That's how the question came in.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'll answer it how I think they might mean it.
Okay.
So you have a value that's being paid for a business. Let's say it's $1 million being paid for a business. What percentage of that is actually going to be financed over time by the seller versus received at closing? That's how I understand the question. So we see anywhere from usually 20 to 40% of the price of the business paid at closing, and the remainder of it's usually paid over time.
All right, very good. So we've kind of covered, we're moving quick, I know, but there's so much to cover here. We kind of covered the seller perspective. Now we're going to transition over to the buyer perspective. Of course, if you still have questions from the seller perspective, feel free to write them in and we'll try to get to them as we go through. But now, Jamie, we're looking at things, hey, we're the buyer now. How do I, as the buyer, determine the value of the business that I'm interested in buying? And I'm sure, I'm sure there's overlap here, but if there's particulars, maybe we could get into them.
Yeah, sure. So what's exciting about being on the buy side and you're looking at a specific target, a specific seller, is you don't have to take all the hypotheticals out now. Now you're looking at a specific seller and you know what that seller's worth, not just overall in the marketplace as an average, but to you specifically. So when you have a specific buyer and a specific seller, you can get deeper into the assumptions. You can determine specific cost savings. For example, you have a buyer and a seller, and the seller has an office space, and the buyer has an office space. You consolidate that, and you can take some rent out of the equation. And now you've created, you know, more cash flow to you as a buyer. So those are important pieces to look at, which you can't necessarily do with a hypothetical buyer, right? So, or a hypothetical seller. So you can get deeper into some of those cost savings. You can get deeper into some synergies. Maybe you're buying a company and they don't offer company stores, but you do. So now you think, wow, let's make a couple of assumptions on we can cross-sell and get some company stores going as well. There's an untapped opportunity there. So there's some things that you can look at there. But it all starts with a basic financial analysis, the same, you know, 5 years of financial statements as the other side, and then you build upon that.
Okay. All right. Very good. Had a question come in. It said, "Is there?" Or it says, "Is there a multiple of gross profit that's typical in the valuation of a distributorship?"
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, back to the disclaimer,
Right.
every distributorship is different. We see somewhere between 80 and 100% usually of gross margin as a rule. But just saying that, you know, I have one I'm working on right now that is much higher than that. So
Okay. What
there
might cause
are
the thing to go, if I could, I'm sorry to interrupt, just what might cause it to go higher like that?
really good question. I'm glad you asked that. I was just about to say, because when you deviate from the norm in terms of models, especially compensation models in this industry, a lot of people are paying really high commission splits, and it's difficult to get the bottom line above a certain level if you're paying that commission split. If you have a model where it's more of an agency model, where you don't have those high commission splits, now you have a lot more on the bottom line, and inherently it's going to be worth more on all multiple levels, right? So it's going to be worth more as a multiple of gross margin because you're making a lot more money.
Okay. All right. Makes
And
very good
again, it comes
sense.
down to that return, that, you know, higher return, the return is higher.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thank you, Jamie. Next one that we had here was, how do you find a good promo business to acquire? And maybe that's a bit of a silly question. Some might already have, if they're thinking about this, they might have somebody in mind. But maybe I'm in a growth phase as a company, and I feel like I'm ready to start making acquisitions that I could I that I that I could grow beyond just organic growth. How do you go about finding that right company?
I mean, I think a multi-pronged approach to growth is great. I commend people for considering it. I think the first thing you need to do, and we're going to go back to on the sell side too, is make that wish list again. Set some parameters. Why do you want to buy a company? What specifically is drawing you in about certain companies? Are you just looking for, are you looking for market position? Are you looking for a company with certain capabilities? So set some parameters, maybe they're geographical parameters, you know, and that's where you have to start because you can't just say, I want to buy a company and go looking if you don't really know what you're looking for. So first step, set parameters. And again, competitors make great targets, right? If you guys are competing in the same market and, you know, they seem like they'd be a good fit, you could approach some competitors, especially if they, you know, they have an older owner and no second generation to take over. They can make some great targets as well. So there are, again, there are lists, you know, you can contact people based on lists. I tend to think personal contact, you know, goes a long way, owner to owner. So look within your groups, maybe talk to specific people. I mean, talk to, if you're a distributor, talk to suppliers, and the suppliers might have some ideas of people that are, you know, oh, so and so's got a great company, but he's getting older. He doesn't have a son or a daughter or, you know, something to take over the company, and then maybe make that contact.
Interesting. All right, very good stuff. One question as you were talking, it kind of occurred to me. Are most acquisitions that occur in our industry, do they fall within a geographic parameter? Is it often one company in this particular location looking to acquire either a company relatively nearby them or a company that's in a market they want to be in? Is geographic always a very big factor in what drives an acquisition?
It used to be more so, but now that we've gone, you know, everybody's got a remote aspect of their business and everybody's cloud-based, it's not as much. But just to say that, I mean, I have people that come to me all the time that say, I want to buy a company. It can be anywhere, it can be any size. And I can't look for that, you know,
Right.
that's everything.
Let's
So,
narrow that down a little.
yeah. That's the reason I say to set parameters so that you have somewhere to start. And you can always move those parameters around, but try and be specific in the beginning just so that you have some place to start.
Okay. All right. So let's say now you've narrowed it down. You've taken Jamie's advice. You've narrowed it down, your parameters, and you've looked intelligently within those, and you have found a business that you're interested in acquiring. Now, I mean, you're not sure it's a slam dunk, but you're interested, and it could be good. What do you then start to take into consideration to make sure that this could be a good purchase and a good fit for your business, or maybe not?
Right.
What's kind of like that process look like?
Right. Well, I mean, you're not going to know a lot about the company without having a conversation. So the outward appearance is important, but it only tells you so much. Sometimes you could think a company is a certain size and it's much smaller, much larger. So you want to start by having that conversation and start learning more about it. Things that you want to learn about are their culture. You want to learn about their people. You want to learn about the owners and, you know, what their values are. Those things are really important because a lot of that is top down, you know, in terms of the values and the integrity and all of that. Maybe you're really interested in social impact. Are they interested in social impact? You know, think about those things and look at those things. Those are all those qualitative things that we don't look at on the financial statement. You have to like the people. The people in this industry are just so important, as are the cultures of the businesses. So it doesn't mean the company has to be just like yours, but it has to at least be complementary. And beyond that, you know, there are the financial things. Once you get to the point where they're comfortable sharing financials, they either have to make money or you have to be able to make them make money. They just don't want to buy a company that's not going to make money because then it's going to draw the purchasing company down and hold them back. So the whole point is growth. And when I talk about growth, I mean earnings growth, not just revenue growth.
Very good. We had another question come in. I'll read it to you here, Jamie. It says, I own a distributorship. Do buyers usually keep or get rid of existing admins and production staff? I employ a bookkeeper, a graphic artist, embroidery operator, and production coordinator, and I handle all the sales.
That's a good question. I've heard buyers say, in terms of admin people, a bookkeeper, probably not. Probably a bookkeeper, they're going to have their own accounting staff. That doesn't mean for sure, but usually they have their own accounting staff. Production people are a different story because if they're good at what they do, then they're worth keeping. I've heard buyers say that over and over. It's hard to find good employees. It's hard to find people that know the industry. So if they're good employees and they know the industry, then they'll find a place for them or they'll keep them where they're at. And in terms of an embroidery machine, it depends on whether they want to keep the embroidery operation at all. I mean, when you have a distributor and then you bring embroidery and that sort of thing into it, now you've created a distributor that does production, and that's not everybody's interest, and that's not everybody's strength. So a lot of distributors will look at that and say, I'll outsource that. I'm not interested in being on the production side of things. So a lot of distributors won't want that aspect of the business unless it's absolutely integral to keeping sales where they're at.
Okay. All right. So it's most basic terms. It kind of depends on the situation and what your goals are for.
Right.
Okay. All right. Very good. Another question that's come up is just how do you determine as a buyer what to actually acquire? And this sort of dovetails even off what we were just talking about a bit. Just do you buy just a book of business? Do you buy facilities to? Are you bringing our attendee just asked, personnel on? Just how do you kind of answer all those questions, and is there a best way of approaching things?
Sure. So it all boils down to every situation is different, but it all boils down to the needs of the purchaser and the needs to keep the sales and profitability levels where they're at. So you take it one thing at a time. Is the facility important to the ongoing revenue stream? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So you want to look at that. You want to have those thoughtful conversations. If a facility is important, does it have to be that specific facility? Like there's that question. Which employees are essential to the continuity of the business? Which employees are irreplaceable? And which tasks are being duplicated in terms of purchasing the business? A lot of times that is the accounting function. But you never know. I mean, sometimes the purchaser could say, we just lost our accounts receivable person and we really need somebody. So you just never know. Usually when somebody's really good at what they're doing, they'll find a place for them. The smart buyers will find a place for them.
Okay. All right. That goes to your point, I guess, before about production staff. If you found people who are expertise in screen printing and embroidery, it might be hard to replace them at a hand, so you wouldn't want to lose that.
Overall, just are there, I think it's important as a buyer to look at it and say, are there strengths? What are the strengths of this seller? And don't just look at it from a, what can they do for me? But who are they? What are the strengths? And can they potentially fit in? Are they doing something well that we're maybe not doing well, that we could actually, everybody looks at it as what is the buyer going to bring to the table, but the seller might actually bring something to the table as well. Maybe they're good at company stores. Maybe they have a great technology platform. Maybe they have a great HR person, or maybe they have a lot of international experience. There's just a lot of things there that the seller could have going for them. And it's important from the buyer's standpoint to recognize what those are.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you, Jamie. We actually had another question come in here from a seller's perspective. And this attendee asks, if the former owner stays on for a year or two on commission, is it unusual to ask for negotiated commissions over the following 5 years once the seller exits completely?
I not sure. Can you read it again? I'm not sure I understand that question.
Let me see if I could put it. I think they're saying that they if the former owner if the former owner stays on for a year or two on commission, so they're selling actively, it sounds like, for a year or two, is it unusual to ask for negotiated commissions over the following 5 years? So I think they're saying, okay, they're kind of actively selling for 2 years on commission, and then they've set up certain accounts in place, perhaps, and they maybe make a percentage off that
Okay.
forward for a few years. For the attendee, if I have that wrong, just let us know and clarify, and we'll try to answer. But that's how I'm asking that question.
I mean, it sounds like that's the actual purchase of the business. Like, if they're getting some residual on their accounts, that's actually more toward the purchase of the business and not necessarily just commission. I mean, you can kind of categorize it either way. That's not super unusual, although that usually starts the day of the purchase versus after you've left. But I mean, it could go the other way. But one thing that you want to keep in mind is if they're paying you and you're no longer there, then how are they going to pay somebody to actually do the job to sell the clients, right?
Got it.
Like,
Okay.
so it might end up being some sort of split situation that gets smaller and smaller over time.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. I'm a buyer. What are my financing options for acquiring a business? Assuming that I'm not just, swimming in my vault of cash that I can go to at any time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is obviously going to vary by buyer and by credibility of the buyer, but there's SBA loans out there, Small Business Administration loans out there that you can look into. A lot of buyers are private equity backed at this point or investor backed, but the most common in our industry is that the seller is going to be the financer. The seller financing is really common in our industry.
Okay, and we had a question about it before, and you did jump into it, but maybe can you give us just a little more insight into how seller financing might work?
Sure. There's two different ways it can work. One is that the seller basically holds a note. And in this climate where interest rates are so high, that's probably going to be a little bit more common than it has been in the past. So the seller holds a note, they get a specific interest rate on that note, and it's just like a mortgage on a house, just it's a business instead. More common than that, though, is that you're going to pay the seller a certain percentage at closing, and then you're going to continue to pay them a certain percentage of the business's success over maybe a period of between 2 and 5 years. So, as long as things keep going well, you'll keep getting a percentage as the seller of the ongoing success of the business. And that's usually paid on gross margin. So you'll get a percentage at closing, and then you'll get a certain percentage of gross margin for, let's say, 4 years or something like that.
Okay. All right, great stuff. So you've made an acquisition and you're feeling great about it. But that's really only the start, right? That's really only the start. So what does a good post-acquisition plan look like? How do you integrate that business into your own and make sure that this money you're paying to have bought this business is actually going to, lead to things and be fruitful?
Right. No, it's a really good question. It's also a really big question that I feel like we could do a whole webinar on.
Okay.
This is, but having said that, I'll say that there's maybe some principles that can guide you here. First thing, have a plan. A lot of people don't have a specific plan. Have a plan in place, and don't just think that things are just going to naturally fall into place. Address all aspects of the business, from people to technology, and most of all, your customers, and how it's going to look in the integration and make it as seamless as possible. The most successful plans are ones where the buyer and the seller work on it together and they present it together, especially to the employees, especially to the employees, to know that everybody's on the same page. And that's what I said earlier, don't tell people that don't need to know that you're going to sell your business, and don't tell them until you have the answers in place. Now you have the answers to their questions. So you make the presentation, you tell them what's going on, and they ask you a question, and you actually have the answer for them. This is when you start doing that. But be transparent. Be transparent about what's going on with the employees once the acquisition's done, and be very clear about ongoing roles. And just, be as thoughtful as possible in the entire process.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jamie. We'll let everybody know that kind of to the end here. So if you have any other questions, please put them in the chat now. And at this point, Jamie, I'll just ask you, is there any final thoughts or big takeaways you think that, you know, maybe a prospective buyer and a prospective seller should walk away with from today?
I think people talk about price all the time, and I think timing is just as important as price. When is it going to be right for you to sell your business? And I think because we have an industry where there is a lot of post-sale involvement and post-sale value being paid, we need to be thoughtful about timing. And if you might want to be out of the business completely in 5 years, you should probably start the process now. You know, you should probably start at least getting a valuation and all of that now. And frankly, that wish list that I talked about earlier, even if you're, you know, 20 years from selling your business, it's never too early to start thinking about some of those things, what you might want or need in, you know, retirement, or, you know, maybe you're not retiring, maybe you're just moving on to something else. But it's never too soon to start thinking about some of those things and building your company in a thoughtful way that makes it easy to transition and valuable to somebody else.
All right. All right. Very good. We did have a question come in, so I'm going to throw it to you since we still have a bit of time. Thank you. Just as this person asked, as a seller, is it better to sell to a buyer that is a larger company versus a buyer that's the same size or smaller than my business?
That's going to depend on the size of your business. If you're talking about business that's doing like 500,000 in revenue, you can probably sell that to an individual, and it would probably work out okay as long as that individual knows what they're doing. But if you're talking about maybe a $2 million company buying a $5 million company, that's going to be a lot to swallow. You know, that's going to be a huge undertaking, and that's going to be, you know, more difficult. So I don't think there is any like right buyer size necessarily, but generally, you know, the natural way that it goes is this company that's larger purchases a company that's smaller.
All right, everybody. Well, you don't see any more questions in there now. So we've kind of come to the end of the webinar. You've been hearing today, of course, from Jamie Watson, a certified marketing consultant. She's a partner with the firm. She is, as you've heard, if you've listened for even part of this webcast, really one of the if not the leading expert on mergers and acquisitions in the promotional products industry. She's an extremely helpful source for us at ASI Media, where we come to her with questions all the time about mergers and acquisitions, and she provides the excellent perspective that you heard today. So if you have any questions for Jamie, please do look her up. CMC could probably give you a lot of help if you are interested in buying or selling a business. So Jamie, I just want to thank you again for giving of your time and your expertise today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.